missing persons reports continue to rise as stadiums empty wherever Arsenal go, plus Rice is very nice about the strikers, and after only scoring 6 against Sheffield United, we question if the Gunners really have what it takes to beat the behemoth that is Brentford. That's all coming up on this episode of The Arsenal Beat. Yes, hello and welcome to The Arsenal Beat. The astute among you will have noticed that it's Kaya Kainak here at Football.London. On hosting duties, no Markman Bryans, I'm afraid. So fans of him among you listeners, I'm very, very sorry you're stuck with me. But I am doing the best to make it up to you by bringing you not just one, but two Arsenal covering Jordans. We have Jordan Campbell of The Athletic and Jordan Davis of The Sun. Gents, how are we?
Very well, very well.
Yeah, I'm good. I'll let Jordan take the first one because he thinks he's got the rightful claim to the name. So I thought I would let him go faster.
I feel like we should have you each individually say your own name so that listeners are able to tell when I say Jordan which one's which. I realised just now what a nightmare that's going to be when I'm referring to you guys.
Well, most English people think that I'm saying John when I say my name, so maybe that'll make it easier.
John. There we go. John.
John's very easy. I mean, there's lots of chat about which of you two is the best Jordan consistently throughout the Arsenal pack. I have to say, after our trip to Sheffield on Monday night, my personal leaning is towards Jordan Davis after being the man who provided me with dinner and the Subway saviour, I'm calling you, Jordan, after what was a terrible, terrible experience for us all at Bramall Lane, wasn't it?
It was a real shock to the system. Never have I been more aghast, angry, let down by a club not to provide. Well, they did provide food, but only until after we arrived. And rumour has it that the Sky Sports lads took it all. So I'm blaming Alan Smith mainly. he's now off my Arsenal legends list for good. That's him done. I went to a Subway and I brought home sandwiches for the boys, which is my job.
We're often asked as football journalists how we maintain such peak physical condition.
It's a foot-long Subway, and
exactly.
That's what it is.
Exactly.
I think someone did say to us, Kaya, that we are 90% pie.
Yes.
It was a great start to the evening.
It was. Jordan Campbell, what was your Subway order of choice? What did you go for?
I am a chicken chipotle sort of guy. But I mean, I wasn't as upset with a lack of food. But I guess these are a bit pampered, the English lot down here, the Arsenal pack. So up in Scotland, real lucky if we get a Scotch pie. So, you know, I was quite happy to go with it, but Jordan did deliver. So maybe chucked on an extra pound delivery, I think, with the money we sent him, but we'll let him off.
Davis, what was your Subway of choice?
I went for the brand new one in Subway. Apparently it's brand new. Garlic steak something. It was just very big and very meaty, so that's what I went for. But it was just quite stressful to get three orders because I think the Subway lot were more overwhelmed by my order than anyone else's, and it's as if they had a blitz in there just before the game. So
I feel like we should stop mentioning Subway now unless they're going to offer us a sponsorship deal for the podcast. We are open to it. The commercial team will be in touch. Subway sandwiches, so do give us a shout. But we should probably start talking about what's going up on the podcast. We'll of course be discussing Arsenal's upcoming game against Brentford this weekend, looking at the goalkeeping situation there, Aaron Ramsdale getting his chance and deciding once for all who the best Jordan actually is in a game. Of course, the only way we know how to settle debates here on the Arsenal Beat podcast with a game of Guess the Gooner. But before then, let's talk Arsenal 6, Sheffield United 0. Gents, there's been a lot of chat about how bad Sheffield United were. And I think, Jordan Davis, you went so far as to say to me that the sooner they get relegated, the better. But are we maybe doing Arsenal a bit of a disservice by making Monday night a Sheffield United story? I mean, I'm just going to reel off some of the stats that Arsenal have been putting up in their recent matches. 31 goals in 7 games since the winter break, just 3 conceded. Best goal difference in the league, most goals scored, least conceded. First team in top 4 divisions history ever to win 3 consecutive games by 5 or more goals. Is there a possibility that we're maybe not giving Arsenal enough credit here, Jordan Davis? I'm going to go for.
Arsenal were fantastic. It was the most Man City I've ever seen them. They were just killers, and they knew within the first 30 seconds that the game was going to be won just by how many. And to have three goals in the first 15 minutes, I don't think I've seen an Arsenal side do that to that extent. And then not to let off and to continue scoring. And they were brilliant. And I realised that in my own report, I even referenced it myself, that we need to mention how good Arsenal were. But I did wander over the press box at half-time and speak to Jordan Campbell. And he will back me up here. I was livid with how Sheffield United were playing. I was angry. I went a bit Roy Keane and just said, why don't we just kick someone? I mean, in the first couple of minutes, they sat back in a back four and thought that Arsenal would just not respond, or they thought that Arsenal would be a bit nervous. And it was the complete opposite. And the first foul they made was in the 29th minute. And that, for me, is unforgivable. When you're playing against an Arsenal team that can be... you saw it against Porto. If you put pressure on them in certain situations, there is a chance that they freeze. It hasn't happened often this season, but against Porto it did. So they should have watched the Porto game and thought, we're going to play like that and be a horrible team to play against, win fouls, make fouls, and make it an unpleasant place to be. And they rolled out the red carpet for Arsenal and they let them play. And the amount of times they let them cut back from the byline. That, if you open Mikel Arteta's book of how to win a football game and how to score goals, that is there. Force it to the byline, pull it back, and we'll have two or three players running at different directions into the box. And they did that numerous times, mostly with the first goal, and then the own goal came from Saka on the byline, and then they pulled it back again for Rice's goal. I've never been more angry at an away team, just because you know how good Arsenal are, so why play like that? And then Chris Wilder changes formation after 15 minutes and brings Norwood off, who, by the way, looked fuming and went down the tunnel straight away. But just play farther back straight away. Sorry. I'm still riled up by it because Arsenal played very well, but they were probably given more pundits than they possibly deserved because of how bad Sheffield United were. And if they're going to play like that, then you may as well just say, see him in Championship, guys, now, because there's, 11 games left. And if they play like that for 11 more games, I don't want to watch them, certainly.
I mean, John, Arsenal, obviously, you know, Jordan's right to be angry with how badly Sheffield United were playing. It got to a point where I think, at least, I didn't find it entertaining to watch. I know, obviously, I'm sure Arsenal fans really enjoyed it, and it was very entertaining from that perspective. But I think from a neutral perspective, it must have been maybe not the most entertaining of games to watch. And do you think that's, again, all the chat after Burnley was how poor Burnley were, all the chat after West Ham was how poor West Ham were, a lot of the chat after Newcastle was Newcastle were a really poor side. Is that a good thing for Arsenal? Do you think they'll be liking the fact they're slightly going under the radar and maybe teams are still underestimating them a bit? Or do you think maybe Mikel Arteta will want a bit more praise coming his side's way?
Yeah, no, I'm sure they'll like, you know, being on the shoulder and not everyone talking about them like they were last season. But I think, you know, we're probably doing them a little disservice if we think that all these teams are just having off days against them. You know, that Sheffield United team are well out their depth. We can clearly see that. But, you know, it got to the point after 15 minutes, you were actually feeling sorry for the Sheffield United players. You were thinking, oh God, I hope this doesn't get too ugly for them, because it was that level of embarrassment. You know, there was one point, Jordan was talking about the first foul in the 29th minute. That came after Arsenal had started popping it around first time outside the box. It was like a rondo. You know, it was just, they could not get anywhere near them. I don't know if whether they intentionally sat off them or they just could not get near them. But Bogle just clearly lost it and had enough. But I think that's what the best teams do. You know, there's no letting up steam after two or three goals. There's no sense of feeling pity for the opposition. You've got to keep your foot to the floor. And, you know, we've been talking about Arsenal scoring for fun now, but, you know, Newcastle were out of sorts, but that was because Arsenal pressed the life out of them. You know, I could go through the stats at the time. It was 29 misplaced passes in their own half, which is the most any team has given away in the first half of this season at any game. You know, that doesn't happen by Bruno having a bad game. It's because Arsenal make him have a bad game. And I just thought, they completely suffocated Sheffield United again. You know, we've talked about three goals, but it's actually unlucky that they've conceded three goals in six games this year. The XG is below two. Well, it was 1.8 before the Sheffield United game, and even Man City were 3.5 times higher than that. Newcastle were over 20. It is incredible the numbers Arsenal are posting. So, yeah, I think they'll enjoy the fact that people were saying, oh, well, maybe it's these teams are poor, but I think Arsenal are just in the zone. They're on autopilot, and we've spoken about the fast starts. That's what was missing this year. Arteta kept talking about the game state. The longer these teams are in the game, the more they can sit back and frustrate, whereas they're taking them apart early doors, forcing them to come out a little, and then completely, you know, annihilating them. So it was Eddie Jones, I think, that was talking about that. Obviously, he's part of that managerial worldwide Intersport group, and he was talking about the one thing he got from Arteta was about how they start the game perfectly. It's almost like they plan the game and it goes exactly how they imagined it. And that's happening every single week now. So, yeah, I think they just look in the groove.
Jordan Davis, obviously we're going to talk about the intensity that Arsenal showed, and Jordan Campbell mentions it there, the level of sort of relentlessness that Arsenal showed. But the other part of the mentality I want to talk about is, you mentioned the foul. I think the first foul was that Jaden Bogle tackle, wasn't it, on Ødegaard? Or maybe that was a different one, but that was certainly...
No, I think it was, yeah. And that was okay.
Yeah. That's the kind of tackle when Arsenal received it in the past. You think maybe they might have gone into their shell. And in your match report, you mentioned the Chris Wilder programme notes when he was talking about a few years ago how Arsenal had come to Bramall Lane and struggled, and Wilder was obviously the coach then. And the tactics were relatively similar that day. Obviously, Sheffield United's intensity and mentality and all that stuff we've spoken about a lot now. But do you think that robustness in terms of getting kicked but not letting it cow them away from their game and keeping going and just keeping doing what they're doing and not really paying any mind to the tactics apart from the Porto game that the opposition are trying to employ, do you think that's arguably been as important as all the attacking fluency and all the things we talk about in this really good run for Arsenal?
Yeah, and I think it's more how you respond to being kicked. I mean, Bukayo Saka gets kicked 6-7 times a game. You very rarely see him respond. Martin Odegaard barely responded to that Bogle tackle, which I know I was saying that it was good that he put in that tackle, but it was a pretty horrible tackle. I mean, he was knackered and gave up and just thought he'd kick someone, which was about time, but it was still a bad tackle. Yeah, and I feel like Arteta likes all these weird and wonderful kind of mental mind games, and I'm sure one of them will have been how we respond to being kicked, being fouled. Declan Rice mentioned in the mix zone that Mikel Arteta just loves body language. He can't get enough of it, and he was fuming at them. I remember after the Fulham game on New Year's Eve about their body language, and every time they missed a shot or missed a chance, their body would go down, and then they would look upset, and then it would affect the whole team. And it almost takes me back to Anfield last season, when Granit Xhaka squared up to Trent after a bit of shoving, and then suddenly that seemed to spark the entire ground, and then Arsenal were 2-0 up, and then they conceded before half time, and then they go and draw 2-2, and that was kind of one of the games that meant that they ultimately missed out on the title. And I think that's massive. I think this team, you look around now, it's so young, but it's just so it doesn't care about noise. It doesn't care about what you're going to do to me on the pitch. We're just going to keep playing on, playing and playing in the very Mikel Man City way, and I can't see them blowing up in a game for the rest of the season. I could be wrong. They could suddenly go to the Etihad and they could suddenly have fist fights and kind of get a few players sent off, but I just can't see them doing again what they did at St James's Park earlier this season. That was very... I don't think Mikel was happy with how his team acted on the pitch and how they reacted, and it took away from their game. And it's all about for Mikel focusing on their game and playing that no matter what.
Playing no matter what is something that Eddie Nketiah, Reece Nelson and Emile Smith-Rowe haven't been doing recently. Probably a bit of a harsh way to phrase that, but none of them have started since January. Campbell, I'm going to come to you on this. You can obviously trust the journalist to find the negative out of a 6-0 performance, but those three, do you think it's strange that Arteta didn't bring them on, or any of the three of them on? Or, you know, there's obviously individual circumstances within games. He wants to give players minutes. And do you sort of sympathise with him? Or do you think, no, that's when you play Eddie Nketiah. That's when you play Emile Smith-Rowe. That's when you play Reece Nelson. Do you think you maybe missed a bit of a trick by not including those Hale Enders.
Yeah, I mean, I did expect to see Smith Rowe especially. I did expect to see him, if not half time, it's certainly the last 20 minutes or 30 minutes. But especially when you bring on Cedric Suarez at right back, when you're like, what are you actually learning from him, you know, by bringing him onto the game? You know, he's not in the plans. He's sort of a last resort player in the squad. And I think you even saw him when he came on. It was such an easy game, but you saw the difference in level where he was putting the ball down the channel and just didn't look to be on the same wavelength as a lot of the other players. So I found that a little surprising, but in Arteta's defence, he sees them every single day. And he was speaking after the game saying that, you know, everyone's got to earn their minutes. He's not just going to hand out minutes without, you know, it being earned during the week. So, I think we thought this was going to be a massive 6 months for Smith Rowe, and he's not had the minutes to prove himself, really. But it's up to him to prove that he is worth bringing on to make an impact. I think Nelson has always looked better coming off the bench. Maybe he's okay with being a squad player, but I think Arteta, when he's building this team in the summer and the next couple of windows, he's going to be ruthless again, and he's going to look to lift the level wherever he can. And I don't think that because the Hale Enders will save them. So, you know, I look at those players and I think, you know, are they being phased out, or is it just not enough space to give them game time? But I would imagine that when he's looking at where can we, those marginal gains, where can we actually improve, they'll be three of the players where he'll look to shift it again.
Davis, do you think any of them have a future at Arsenal, any of the three of them? Or do you think this summer, chance for Arsenal's cash in, they need to raise a bit of funds to go out and strengthen again, and we'll probably come onto the striking position a little bit later. That's expensive. Lots of places where Arsenal want to improve. Do you think any of them have a future at the Emirates?
I feel like Smith Rowe does. I feel like Arteta sees Smith Rowe and he sees what he can get out of him and try and getting him back to the levels that he once was. I could be wrong, but I just think Eddie mentally is out. I think he knows that he's done to not get a game. I kind of understand why Arteta didn't bring them on against Sheffield United, purely because he had Partey to bring on. He had Jesus to bring on. So I can see why. But yeah, no, it's frustrating. I agree with Campbell that Nelson, I think he's okay being a squad player. I could be wrong and he could be fuming it and he could be banging on Arteta's door, but I feel like he knows his place in this team. I feel like he enjoys himself. I feel like he gets on with everyone. And I agree that he looks better coming off the bench. But no, out of the three of them, I'd be very, very surprised if Eddie was still at the club this summer. And he's still got years on his contract and he should bring in a reasonable fee. And you're right that Arsenal need to raise funds. I know they have money anyway to spend, but they'll be wanting to raise funds. And I'm sure Eddie will be one who's out the door. And good for him, because actually he deserves to have a better career than the one he's currently having.
I was just going to add to that, Kaya, that, you know, when you look at how the teams raise money now in the Premier League, that is the area that all teams are looking at. Big academies are looking at, we can put them as full profit on the accounts, which I don't think is personally a good thing. I think it's actually disincentivising teams from producing first-team players. They're just seeing it as now a factory. And maybe that's to do with, maybe that's why Arsenal seem to be going quite big on bringing in teenagers this summer. But, you know, I think Nketiah, like Jordan said, he does look surplus to requirements now. You've got Jesus, and when Jesus is not playing, Arteta's gone with Havertz and Trossard, and Arsenal have looked so much more fluid with those players starting recently. I think that's sort of been the final nail in the coffin, really, is that when you're playing midfielders in front of Nketiah and it's not disrupting the team, they actually look more joined up. That's not a great, you know, it's not a good indictment of how he's progressed from last year, because I thought he'd actually maybe harshly criticised last year. I thought overall when Jesus was injured, he was actually pretty good, but I just don't think he's made that next step up again. And he'll, you know, I'm sure there were Premier League takers for him, but I just don't think his level's at Arsenal.
Jordan, you obviously spoke to Declan Rice in the mix zone after the game, and it's interesting that we're obviously talking about striking positions and Eddie potentially leaving and Arsenal playing Brentford this weekend, and and Ivan Toney potentially being a target. But when you spoke to him, he sort of seemed to suggest that, that Arsenal didn't actually need another striker.
Yeah, I think there was a narrative that we weren't creating chances, that we needed a number nine. But honestly, we've been playing like this all year. All season we've been playing really well. Obviously the goals weren't as free-flowing as they are now, but that was never a problem that we needed a number nine, because we've got Gabby, we've got Kai, we've got Eddie, you know, we've got Leo who can play false nine. You know, goals are going to come. So I don't think that's ever been a big problem. It's just about, yeah, I think now we're really in our groove and we're looking really threatening in front of goal.
Declan Rice there seemingly suggests that Arsenal didn't actually need a striker all along. Jordan Davis, is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I mean, he called it the narrative that's been going around, which made me kind of chuckle inside, because it means that he's clearly been reading our pieces and been kind of keeping it in tune with what we're saying about it. But no, yeah, no, he was quite adamant. I think he was, and when we spoke to him, he was quite laughy and kind of making jokes and stuff. But when we got to that question, he was very serious and just said that it's been outside noise again, just not caring what other people think. And actually, he said that when Havertz, Trossard, Gabby, even Eddie have come in, they've been able to score goals. And crucially, he said that they've been creating chances. It hasn't, but as if they've just had no XG and they've just been kind of feeding off scraps. They've made tons of chances this season, and the argument's still there that if they had a proper number nine who played week in, week out, would they have more goals than they do now, which is more than they've ever had? Possibly, but again, it's the way they play, and it's again, as I said earlier, getting to the byline and cutting back, and that's what they like doing. It isn't about picking the ball up and whipping it across and there you go. Again, they could change if they suddenly had a number nine like that, but it works for them. City did it for years. Liverpool did it for years. Arteta has, I think he's now been convinced that they can do it. I think when we've been asking about him at the start of the season, he's probably said yes, but then in his head, not really being sure whether they can. I think his own players have proven him right. So I think he's just fine to go along with it, and it's getting the results that they're getting.
Similar question for you, other Jordan. Do you think they need a striker or no?
Well, just when Jordan was saying about him being proven right, you know, my mind goes back to when we were in America and we were speaking to him, and he was saying, you know, we're probably not going to have a 50-goal-a-season striker like Haaland. So, you know, do we think that we can share the responsibility and match them that way? And he's like, well, I hope so. And, you know, I think over that Christmas period where they'd won 1-7, that was when I think we all thought they don't have those killers up front. But to me, the bigger problem for the first 3 or 4 months of the season was actually the creativity. You know, they've been creating a lot of chances now for the last 2 or 3 months, but the first 3-4 months of the season, it was a little bit, the play was a little bit stodgy. And, you know, look at Odegaard now. I think you see the difference in him. And to me, he's a sort of microcosm of how Arsenal have developed as the season's gone on. They're finding so much more space. And I think even with the cutbacks, I think that's because they're now overloading both wide areas so much now. Kiwior playing as a bit more of a functional left-back has helped Martinelli, I think, a lot. Rice was playing really high up as a left eight. It's not just so much Saka and Martinelli doubled up, tripled up at times, having to come back inside. White's getting a lot higher up now. And it seems to me that Arteta's almost just putting two halves of his team out wide and they're working it and getting in behind and then cutting back. And it's proven to work really well. But I think we flip-flop, don't we, on do they need a striker? I think, could they upgrade on the striker? I think yes. They don't have a top world-class finisher in the squad. But I don't think that is going to make or break the season until the end, this running. I don't think that's going to be the deciding factor. I think it'll be whether they can still maintain that defensive solidity and keep this fluency they've got going forward, because they've shown that they have got players who can be ruthless. They were ruthless there. They've been ruthless the last 2 months. So to me, it's a longer-term question about if Arsenal win the league, can they still upgrade? And I think if they win the league without a striker, they should probably still go and get one, because that's what you need to do when you are trying to be the elite of the elite, is you you can't ever think, oh, well, that's us got the perfect team. There's always going to be a couple of spaces in the team that when you bring someone in, fans are a bit shocked and go, oh, well, he's just done this. It's a little bit like letting Xhaka go. You think, God, that guy's just had the greatest revival arc anyone's ever seen, and then we've let him go. Same with Ramsdale, you're thinking, this is really harsh, but I think that'll be the next one. Even if they do win the league, it's like, oh, well, Havertz has actually turned out really well. Jesus has maybe had a big contribution towards the end of the season. We'll see. But I think it's one of those that, no matter, regardless of the result, I think it's probably something Arsenal will look to do.
Now, obviously, Arsenal's chance of winning the league will be massively bolstered if they can beat Brentford this weekend, where they'll be looking to go on top of the Premier League ahead of Man City and Liverpool playing each other on the Sunday. Before Brentford arriving at the Emirates, to get the inside track on this weekend's Arsenal opponents, I spoke to Jay Harris of The Athletic. So, Jay, over the weekend, Thomas Frank seemed to respond, I think, maybe to your question about the boos that Brentford fans were giving him. And I guess from an outsider's perspective, they do seem a little bit harsh. Brentford's maybe not having the best of seasons, but lots of injuries and things that have gone against them. And they were sort of 1-0 down to Chelsea, obviously, despite their own issues, are a big team. But is there any sort of, I guess, credence to it? Do you think it's fair that some Brentford fans are booing? Can you see why they might be upset, or is that just totally out of order?
I think it was a little, I wouldn't use the term out of order, but it took me by surprise, which is why I asked the question. If you listen back, I even say, I think I heard boos. I wasn't 100% sure that I'd heard, but certainly this is my third season covering the club, certainly felt like they were being directed at the team and at Thomas Frank. I can sort of understand why some fans were booing. It's been a difficult season. You know, this time a year ago, they were in the middle of a 12-match unbeaten run. They ended up finishing ninth, just missed out on Europe. And I think the feeling was, this is a club that's going places. And that momentum's been completely ripped away from them this season. Every team struggling with injuries in the Premier League, we know it's been a really strange season for that. But Brentford just seems to have been so unlucky. They're starting back four, back five from last season are no longer available. It seems like they've got a new injury every other week. You know, Ben Mee's fractured his ankle and is out for the season. Pinnock and Brown and Boomer won't be back until after the March international break. So I think it was less frustration at Thomas Frank and at the team. It was more frustration at the situation. But obviously it's not nice for the players and the manager to hear that, which is why I questioned Thomas Frank on it.
Do you think injuries are the only reason that the momentum's been so stunted since last season? Or do you think has tactically something changed? Has something gone wrong? Or is it just injuries?
I think there's been a few teething problems with some of the players they've signed over the last couple of years. Mikkel Damsgaard's one example. You know, he's a player that everybody can remember because he scored that, you know, ridiculous free kick against England at the Euros. I think it was 3 years ago now. Since then, he struggled with injuries. That's one of the reasons Brentford were able to buy him at a really discounted price. But his second season in the Premier League now, and we've still not really seen enough from him. Same with Keane Lewis-Potter. He was a club record signing when he joined in July 2022. And he's finally starting to show some of the promise, but it took him 18 months to score his first goal in the Premier League, and he's a winger. Obviously, they coped quite well without Tony in the beginning. And then I think when Mbeumo was taken from the team for injury as well, you started to realise that, you know, you lose your two best attacking outlets and any team's going to struggle. And I also think, you know, David Raya, a player who won't be involved this weekend, but, you know, who's obviously got big links to both teams. I think losing him has been a bigger hurdle for the club to overcome than maybe they anticipated. Mark Flecken started to put in some good performances in the last couple of weeks, but certainly in the first few months of the season, he looked a little bit shaky and maybe unpredictable at times, which is not what you want from a goalkeeper. And so that, coupled with the injuries, meant that he was playing in front of a different back four every week. And it's obviously very hard to foster those relationships and build a really solid defensive foundation if you can't breed that familiarity. So also just got to talk about Nathan Collins. He's at the moment club record signing. They have just recently signed a Brazilian striker called Igor Thiago from Club Brugge, but he doesn't join until the summer. But Collins started the season really well, and then he's gone through a very strange period of form. I know lots of people can remember when Brentford played Wolves around New Year and he made two quite big errors. One of them, he passed it straight to Hwang Hee-chan, who scored. And it was similar against Liverpool. It was a player who, like I said, came in at a big price tag in the summer, was very much being billed as the future of Brentford's back three. and he's just not played very well, and he's been dropped for the last couple of games. So there's been loads of different issues for Thomas Frank to deal with. He's had to spin a lot of plates. I've not even really mentioned the Ivan Toney situation. Of course, that will impact the dynamics of a team. Thomas Frank was asked about it in every single press conference. That must have just become a little bit draining after a while. So they've actually kind of done quite well to still have their head above the water when you consider everything.
Seeing as you're mentioning how draining it is to talk about Ivan Toney, let's talk about it a little bit more. Has he been since he's come back? Because it's been a little while now, and on the face of it, he's been scoring goals, and obviously there's that reported interest from, you know, too many teams in the Premier League to count. But how's he done? Has there been any ring rust, or has he just got straight back into the swing of things?
I think that first game he came back was the expectations were so high, and you know, Brentford had, you know, really build up his return. I was there on the day, and they, you know, they used the Undertaker's theme music when Toney was walking out onto the pitch, or just before he came out onto the pitch. The club didn't commission this, but there was a massive billboard in West London all about Toney, and I think it was called "The King Is Back." And it felt like if this goes wrong, this could be a little bit embarrassing. But then he scores that free kick and kind of reminds everybody why he is such a talent and why so many teams want him. And certainly, Toney is a good player, but it's also just he has a little bit of an aura about him. He's, I think he's Brentford's vice-captain at the moment, just after Christian Norgaard. And you do see the impact he has on the players around him. And certainly, the couple of conversations I've had with people at the club behind the scenes have said, you know, Ivan's return, Toney's return, the impact that's had on the squad's morale has been massive. I think he scored 4 goals in 8 appearances since he's been back now. I personally think he got an assist against Man City when he kind of budges Ake out the way, although it won't go down as an official assist. So he's, you know, he's kind of got back into the swing of things straight away. Still not perfect. I don't think you would be after 8 months out. And you've also got to think he's now playing up front with Neil Mopay. And Neil Mopay is a very different profile of striker to Brian Mbeumo and Johan Visser and Kevin Schaarder, who Toney was used to playing with. They're very quick forwards, like to play on the last line of the shoulder, and you know, Toney can flick it on, whereas I think it's fair to say Mopay's not the quickest. So I think Tony's had to adapt his game slightly to complement the new players that Brentford have got, but he's still such a talent. I just feel like at the moment, that initial excitement of Toney coming back and all that adrenaline he would have been feeling has kind of worn off, because just the team have not managed to get themselves out of this difficult situation. And you could see him get a little bit frustrated against Chelsea in the 2-2 draw. But he will also say that he's very much a driver of standards for Brentford. And he will tell people off, I guess, on the football pitch about you should have made this run or you should have made that run. But as soon as the game's over, he's very much, you know, I guess, a bit of a loving figure to them. So very good return, but not perfect. But that's more because of Brentford's results.
You mentioned Neil Mopay there. He's obviously someone who Arsenal fans know very well, mostly from his time at Brighton, where obviously the Guendouzi clash and the Leno stuff, yeah, and all that stuff, and more or less everything since. I mean, even last season when he was at Everton, obviously he got in the face of Zinchenko in that game, and he seems to have a knack for getting under the skin of not just Arsenal fans, in fairness, every group of players and fans he seems to come across. He's actually got a really good record against Arsenal. He scored quite a lot against them. Is that something Arsenal needs to be wary of this weekend? Do they need to watch out for him? Because obviously before joining Brentford, his goal record had been really poor, but he's racked up decent numbers this season.
I think I have to say, if Sky Sports are releasing a video on their YouTube of your best wind-up moments, then you've really hit another level of of quality in that regard. I was quite sceptical of when Brentford re-signed Mopay in the summer. It felt like a very last-ditch move. It felt a little bit desperate. They'd been linked with signing and came really close to signing Johan Bakayoko from PSV Eindhoven, this like really electric winger. And they ended up with Mopay, who I think he'd scored once in 13 months while he was at Everton. And because Mopay had played at Brentford before, it very much felt like, you know, when a band releases their greatest hits album or something like that, they were just hitting the nostalgia button. But the deals worked out far better than I anticipated. So hats off to the people at Brentford. That's why they're in their position and I'm in mine. Mopay has... I think if you create chances for Mopay, he is a very good finisher. He is one of the best finishers at Brentford. And he does just have that habit of being in the right place at the right time. So he's not going to... he's not going to threaten Saliba and Gabriel in the way that other strikers do. When you've got someone who's maybe like Erling Haaland or Marcus Rashford, players who in the right moment on the counter-attack can damage Arsenal, especially when, you know, they're spacing behind with Arsenal. What Arsenal will need to be aware of when they come up against Mope is that he will just make those little movements when there's a set piece or a free kick. And obviously Arsenal have a great set piece record, and Brentford do as well. I think they're both in the top three for goals and chances created from set pieces. That's what Arsenal will need to be a little bit wary of. He can just make those little movements and find that yard of space and tuck away a finish.
Another sort of relationship between this club and Brentford, Arsenal and Brentford, is of course David Raya. He's on loan and he won't be available for this weekend. So I'm not going to ask you what sort of performance you'd be expecting from him. But it was interesting. Obviously, he had it's weird to even call it a difficult start at Arsenal, because he didn't play badly necessarily, but there was all that pressure on him because of Aaron Ramsdale being such a popular figure. I'm interested to sort of get from the Brentford perspective of having witnessed him be so impressive at Brentford for so long, and whether you were always expecting him to come in and take that number one spot away from Aaron Ramsdale, or were you maybe expecting it to be a bit more of a fight than it has been? Because it's been very much, you know, he came in, maybe waited a couple of weeks, and then since then, Ramsdale's not really had a look in.
I was expecting it to be more of a fight, but I did back Raya to eventually win that fight. I'd watched him for two seasons for Brentford in the Premier League, and he'd always hit a really high standard. And lots of people confused that when Brentford went for a really tricky spell in their first season in the Premier League, lots of people put it down to Christian Eriksen that they got out of it. That's partially true, but actually, if you speak to people at the club, they'll say the bigger factor was Raya returned from 4 months out with a knee injury. And he was just obviously so integral to coming off his line, very confident with claiming crosses, all those types of things that Arsenal fans have gotten used to. And Brentford's second choice goalkeeper, Alvaro Fernandez, just couldn't replicate it at that same level. So I knew that Raya going to Arsenal, I thought, okay, give it 6 months and that will eventually work out. I think in terms of, he did have a little bit of a difficult start. I was actually watching some highlights recently and he did look really nervous, especially in the Man City game and in the Chelsea game. I said it at the time and I still say it now. I think people underestimated how big of a move that was for him. You know, he's had quite an unorthodox route to the top in football. You know, started his career out at a local team in Spain. He grew up in Barcelona or on the outskirts of Barcelona, goes to Blackburn Rovers, ends up playing for Southport in non-league, you know, gets promoted with Blackburn Rovers from League One. Then he's playing in the Championship. Then he gets his chance with Brentford in the Premier League. He'd never played in European competition before. I think he'd been capped once by Spain. To go from being one of the best players in a Brentford team, which had quite low expectations surrounding it, to a very pivotal position in an Arsenal team, which after 10 or 15 years of not competing for a title, was suddenly competing for the title again, I think was massive pressure. And he had to, it took him longer than he would have liked, and I'm sure Mikel Arteta would have liked, to just grown accustomed to that pressure. And then you throw in the Ramsdale situation on top of that, and it just became a talking point and for something to point out at every single opportunity. So I think people just needed to realise for Raya, you know, I think he's just recently turned 28. It's taken him a long time to reach this level. And so it was just a massive step up for him. And he just needed to become a little bit more accustomed. When Brentford were playing Liverpool or Man United last season, Brentford were going in with zero expectations. When you're playing Man United and you're Arsenal and it's at the Emirates Stadium, you're expected to win. And any single mistake gets fed through to the crowd. So I'm glad to see that he's kind of overcome that. But yeah, I think people maybe needed to realise it was a huge step up.
Speaking of teams being expected to win, I'm going to give you the question that everyone hates, the score prediction for this weekend. Obviously, Arsenal can go top if they win, and it's a big game. But big game for Brentford too. They can sort of move further away from the relegation zone. But do you see any world in which Brentford are able to stop Arsenal's formidable run at the minute?
Do you know what? Normally, I'm very, very reluctant to go against Brentford, but I think I have to be a little bit pragmatic that Brentford's defensive record is certainly one of the worst, if not the worst, in 2024 in terms of Premier League teams. Maybe it's slightly different after Sheffield United on Monday evening. Arsenal and simply scintillating goal-scoring form. So I think I back Brentford to get Brentford have it within them to win, to get a draw. But I just think at the moment, the form that the two teams are in, you kind of have to say Arsenal are probably going to win. And I could probably see Arsenal winning 2-0. Hopefully no more than that. Brentford don't want to be embarrassed. But they, you never know. You know, they rocked up at the Emirates Stadium last year, obviously got that 1-1 draw. We won't go into the Tony offside goal, but they did play very well that day. So it's not, I wouldn't rule out them coming away with a positive performance. But I think at the moment, especially with Brentford having so many injuries in defence, you know, they're probably going to start Zanka, Collins and Ayer, and they've not played together many times. Arsenal team that's absolutely firing at the moment. I think you have to say Arsenal should win.
Nice. All right then. Well, Jay Harris, thank you very much for your time.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Jay Harris there with all we need to know about Arsenal's opponents this weekend. But from an Arsenal perspective, it's a really interesting one for a number of reasons, not least the goalkeeping situation, which Jay touched on it there. Jordan, one of you just jump in on this. I'm getting confused myself just referring to you two. But Aaron Ramsdale, let's say on Saturday he puts in the performance of his life and saves 20 penalties, makes 50 saves, scores a bicycle kick, whatever you like. Is there any world in which he then plays against Porto in the next game, or is this possibly his last ever game in an Arsenal shirt?
Should we have a countdown and answer at the same time? Because I'm pretty sure our answers will be the same.
What, so yes or no?
Yeah.
All right, okay. 3, 2, 1.
No.
No.
The wonders of a Zoom delay there for you, ladies and gentlemen.
That sounded amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
We won't be doing a duet in karaoke.
All right, who wants to say this? David, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I said about Eddie looking like he's mentally checked out. I don't think Aaron's mentally checked out, but I think he knows that his time at Arsenal is done. I think 3 or 4 months ago, I was still of the opinion that he could still fight his way back, thinking stupidly that Mikel would give him a few more chances than he already has. But yeah, and also I think a lot of us have been proved wrong, because I don't think many of us like to admit it, but I think we all thought that Raya probably wouldn't be as solid as he has been. And actually, Mikel said a few weeks ago about him doing things that you lot don't see. And he's right, the way he collects crosses, his distribution with his hands and his feet, shot stopping, hasn't had to do a lot of it, but when he has done, when Sheffield United had their one and only shot on target and it was offside, and Raya still had to save it. So yeah, Ramsdale can score 50 goals before the end of the season from inside his own box, and he can win England the Euros. I still think he's going to leave Arsenal in the summer, and I think that'll be one of the more interesting sagas for Arsenal this summer, just because of how much money can they get for him. What do they do? Do they bring in another number one who they think, are they going to go and sign Alisson and then suddenly have the same problem again in terms of two number ones, or does Mikel admit that it was a mistake and he's going to bring in someone who's clearly a number two? So yeah, whatever Ramsdale does, I think he knows that he needs to move on for his own career, and Arteta has it fully made up in his mind that David Raya is his number one. And I think he's wanted Raya for 2 or 3 years anyway. And Ramsdale, in all honesty, was probably a bit of a stopgap until he got the keeper he really wanted. And he finally did.
Well, Alisson to Arsenal, you heard it here first, listeners. John Campbell, we were discussing on the train back, actually, a little bit, where Ramsdale could go in the summer, in realistic destinations, because as much as Jordan Davis is right, Arsenal need to sell probably and make a decent bit of money off of Ramsdale if they can. You still need a buy-in club, but do you think there's a likely destination for him? Where do you see him potentially going as a move this summer, if he does leave, in fact?
Well, I mean, you look at the other top teams in the league, and they're either got a pretty set number one or they've recently bought one. I think the two teams you look at are probably Chelsea and Newcastle. Obviously, Chelsea went and got Sanchez from Brighton, spent a fair bit of money on him. Newcastle have got Pope, who's obviously been out injured for a long time. But I think you look at Pope and you think his kicking's always been his weakness, and it's maybe holding him back in terms of international pedigree. So I think that's probably something that Newcastle will look at as well, as they try to become an established force in the top four, top six. So I think those two look like the natural places that he could potentially go. But when you've only played a handful of games each season, the problem, well, this season, the problem becomes how much can Arsenal get from realistically? Because, you know, we've seen it with other players where they're bombed out completely. And I know you have to do that if you pick a new number one with a goalkeeper. It's not like you can rotate them as much as Arteta did suggest you could. You worry about how much his market value has really dropped off, and then Arsenal need to go and get another goalkeeper. But Ramsdale's not going to be happy that he go into a second season as a number two. So I think those two teams are probably the most likely that you look at within the country. Maybe he'll go further afield. I don't know how open he is to that, but it's a big test for him this weekend, because I think we've seen mentally how difficult it is for a goalkeeper to come in from the cold against the team that the guy who's taking the shirt off him is from on loan. You know, you've got it's not just one aspect of pressure. You've got two, and you've got Raya sitting in the stands where the camera's going to be on him as much as it is Ramsdale at the start of the game. And we saw it. I mean, it was quite uncomfortable to watch that first half at Brentford. The nerves really did get to him. There was one where he went to throw the ball out and just, he almost got the yips, you know, and pulled out halfway through. He got bailed out a couple of times. So he did well to recover in the second half and was quite assured, quite accomplished. But yeah, I think Raya has looked more and more settled, especially with the ball at his feet. He looks a lot calmer. I don't think he's been amazing. I think he's been solid, and he has done things that, you know, preemptive things, like he's great at coming out to claim the ball for crosses, takes a lot of pressure off. He is off his line pretty quick to sweep things up. I still think, though, we've not had that one game when you go, that was Raya's game. And I just think it's bound to happen in this running. There's going to be one game where Arsenal are just slightly off it defensively, and he's going to have to come up trumps. So I guess that'll probably define, you know, whether it's been a big, big success or whether he's really moved the needle. So I still think his big moments are to come, because I just don't think Arsenal, don't think any team is going to be as defensively solid for these last 10, 11 games as Arsenal. So yeah, I think the tests are still to come.
Just coming back to the game on Saturday, obviously Porto's coming up a few days after, and in the press conference after the game, Mikel did seem to imply that he's going to make changes for this game. Davis, do you think he should make changes, given that Arsenal have been on such a good run and they've been so fluid and things have been clicking so well? And bear in mind, there's no game after that. Obviously, Chelsea playing in the FA Cup, so Arsenal won't be playing them in the league, and that suspension has sort of given Arsenal a little bit of an extra break. Do you think that's something Arteta will look to do? Will he rotate, or do you think he'll risk it and stick with the team that's been doing so well recently?
I think it'd be mad to rotate. I think it'd be a massive gamble. Just this Arsenal team last year, when you had a few injuries and suddenly you took players out and they pretty much crumbled. I don't think they would this year, but it would be a massive gamble. I think, especially against a team like Brentford and then also Porto, two kind of niggly teams to play against. You want players you can rely on, and you want players to go through their processes and just get it done. I mean, he may be forced into changes. Saka wasn't very well against Sheffield United. That's why he came off. Martinelli's got a fairly bad cut on his foot, so may have to change. But even then, bringing in Trossard and maybe putting Gabby up top and putting Havertz out wide, maybe, or even someone like Smith Rowe. He may be forced into that. And I think he trusts his squad more than he did last season, which is why the likes of Jorginho has come in and done well in Partey's absence. And as well with Kiwior coming in for Zinchenko as well. I think this is a more well-rounded squad. Saying that, I think this is such a massive part of the season. And this break coming up to then Man City and then Spurs away, Villa at home, Man United away. It's you don't mess with a good formula. I think it'd be crazy to. But again, he may have to.
Campbell, do you agree? Do you think if it's a case of it ain't broke, don't fix it?
Yeah, I just don't think you can afford to even dilute any of your team, really, going into this last game before the international break, the last game before you go and play Man City. I think you've got to turn up there with a big, big run, a sequence of big results behind you. Because when City and Liverpool are in this zone, you know, they just go parallel. Win, 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 win. They've done it for 5-6 years now. We've seen it where they don't let up. There's very, very rarely a chink in their armour any week. And I just think that if Arsenal want to be the third team to show that they're that juggernaut, they've got to come in with that aura about them that we are relentless and we are the same as you now. You know, we're not the sort of wannabe title challengers. We're up there. We're one of the giants. So I think you've got to go. I think if they win at the weekend, it'll be a longer chain of wins, consecutive wins than they managed last season. I think this, you know, they matched it, the run they went on last year from January to March. And obviously then the two each game at Liverpool was when things started to unravel. But, you know, come back to actually a point Jordan made earlier about he doesn't think they're going to wilt or have a game where they just completely sort of have a head loss. It was that Liverpool game that I was convinced that they wouldn't drop off significantly. They might tail off a few points, but I just didn't think they would have a dramatic drop off. And it was basically because that second half where Liverpool had the game with a scuff in the neck, they came out absolutely flying. And we've seen last year how Arsenal sort of disintegrated and just could not get the momentum back. And that triangle of Saliba, Gabriel and Rice were phenomenal that day, a couple of months ago. They were just absolutely solid. And then Rice just got the game, controlled it, and just settled them down for 10-15 minutes, and they actually ended the stronger team. And I thought, yeah, that's a big... They might not have won, and they might not have got that sort of final away fixture hoodoo off their back at Anfield. But I thought, yeah, that's a team that look a lot less emotionally up and down than they did last year. I just don't think they're as emotional in games now. So I think they'll just view this game as any other. And we'd actually probably gone into it thinking this could be 3-4-0. That's how confident you are looking at Arsenal. You know, it might end up being a tight game, but I think you're going in with that confidence that they're not going to really look like they did against Bournemouth last year or against Southampton, where it was manic and chaotic. I think you look at them now and go, there are 2 years of consistency, over 2 years of consistency, top-level form. I don't think they're drastically going to drop off now.
Right, speaking of consistency, let me give you a few more stats, listeners. Jordan Davis, guess the Gooners performance. One game played, zero wins. Jordan Campbell, guess the Gooner, one game played, zero wins. Something's got to give, listeners, as we play guess the Gooner. Now, just as a reminder for you, in case you don't remember what the rules are, where have you been, first and foremost? Where have you been listening to this podcast so far? The rules are very simple. Yeah, just in case you can't see, actually, we can see sort of the emotional state that guess the Gooner puts me in. Jordan Davis has been leaning back into his chair. He's breathing heavily.
I'm gonna add to the stat that it was one game, no guesses. Unlike Arsenal, I froze.
You both, won game, no guesses.
I had an XG of zero. Yeah. So, has anyone ever not got it? Like, someone's always got it eventually. Yeah.
I think you'd have to ask Brian's about that. To be fair, I think
that could change.
Today might be the one.
I'd like to see. I'm at a disadvantage. I would just like to say that.
Or are you? We'll have to wait and see.
How far back are we going here? This is my query with this game.
If I told you that would slightly defeat the point of the game. But let me just remind you the rules again, listeners, one more time. So I'm going to read out a list of clues related to an Arsenal player, a mystery Arsenal player, and it'll be up to Jordan Davis or Jordan Campbell to buzz in and say who they think the player is. They're both leaned in very, very closely to their screens, and I can see more forehead than I've seen for the entirety of this podcast. All right, let's play guess the Gooner. All right, clue number one. I played just four times for Arsenal.
Chu Park Young.
Incorrect. But he's off the mark with a guess.
Got my guess in. Come on.
He's got his guess away. Clue number two. On my Arsenal debut, I came on in the 71st minute to replace Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Nico Yanaris?
No. Good guess, though. Very good guess. I have played for two Eredivisie sides, but I've never played in the Eredivisie. So for those of you, that's the Dutch second tier. I've played for two Dutch second tier sides and never played top tier. I represented Germany once at under 17.
Thomas Einfeld.
Oh, fuck.
Incorrect.
Oh, I gave you that there. Oh, we could have got half a point now.
No point sharing in this game. This is a brutal game. It's a winner-takes-all.
What was that last clue again?
I represented Germany once at under 17 level. Moving on to the next clue. I made my senior debut in the 2013-14 season, but have gone on to make just 100 senior club appearances in my career.
Rakic?
Incorrect.
German.
He's not German, is he?
I have won trophies in Holland, America, and Scotland.
Zellerlum?
Oh,
very impressive, Jordan.
Oh, I knew Mark would fit in a little Scottish reference to help me out.
I did this one. This was a kind of original against the Gooner. Yeah, the next clue I think we really would have got, Jordan. This was I played 28 times for Rangers, but never appeared for them in the Scottish Premier League. I have yet to play a senior international game, but I'm eligible to play for Ethiopia, Germany, and the United States.
You know, the German thing threw me because I always think it was American. That was good, that.
He is American. He's played for the Americans at under 18 and up.
I know everyone says this. It was on my tongue. Like Thomas Eisfeld.
Oh, I thought I'd given you that.
I really thought that was it.
I said Thomas, and then I was like, what is it? I know it ends in failed. I was like, what is this?
Thomas Enfield, the famous Arsenal player, Jordan Campbell's guest there, ladies and gentlemen.
Do you know what? I'm not ashamed. I gave it a good go. I guessed.
What was the standard of guessing there? I thought it was all right.
It's a decent standard of guessing. I, for one, am happy that I managed to get past two clues. Simon Collins, one of my debut hosting guest, the Gooner, managed to get my two clues. So I'm glad I got that far. The other clues were I was managed by a former Celtic manager. Does anyone know who that is?
Ronnie Dyler.
Ronnie Dyler at New York City FC, where Gideon Zelanem played for a season. And I am currently playing at the club where Ruud van Nistelrooy began his professional career. Anyone know where that is?
PSV? No.
FC Den Bosch. So that was the final clue. I'm not sure. I'm supposed to get easier as they go, but I don't know if that was actually easier as I went.
I just say that was very Scots orientated? I'll be filing an official complaint on that one.
Zellerlum, yeah. It's funny you mentioned Dyler. My one memory of Zellerlum was in the Championship for Rangers, where that was when everyone was still talking about him being like a big prospect at Arsenal, because I think he was 18 at the time. Mm-hmm. Mark Warburton was the manager. But yeah, he just wasn't quite the level, I think. But he did score a penalty in the semi-final, the shootout, the semi-final against Celtic when Rangers were in the Championship and beat Celtic when Dyler was the manager, actually. So maybe when he signed him later was a sort of therapy for him, really.
Or revenge, given that Zlatan's gone on to have a very, very injury-prone career.
he deliberately spiked his...
All right, that feels like a perfect time to end this episode here with Jordan Campbell smiling like a Cheshire cat and John Davis' head in his hands once again. He'll be back on, hopefully trying to resurrect his guest, the Gooner, faux pas so far. We'll be back hopefully next week before the Porto game, after the Brentford game, to bring you all the reaction to that one. So join us then. Please do follow us on all our social medias. We're on Twitter at the Arsenal Beat, and I think we're on some other platforms as well, Instagram, so look for us there. Make sure to, if you like this, give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, all that kind of good stuff, and share with your friends. Jordan Davis holding up an Iron Brew. Jordan Campbell, even, sorry.
Jordan Campbell.
On the whole podcast without mixing you two up, and I've managed to do it right at the end. Jordan Campbell holding up an Iron Brew extra to celebrate his victory there, the Scottish Cup, as it's otherwise known. Right, we'll be back with you next week. Thank you very much for tuning in, guys. Thank you for listening to the Arsenal Beat.